I hope that out of these tragedies, that there is an opportunity, first, not only to express the intensity of our reactions, but then to get back down to the detailed business of understanding, unpacking the nature and contributions to the problems, as well as to revisit and learn new solutions in achieving greater mastery. That in and of itself could be as much about the work that we do in our psychoanalytic consulting rooms as it is about the work that we attempt to do in the community.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Stephen Marins. Dr. Marins and I first had a podcast conversation last September 2019. It's episode 16 on the podcast. And this is being recorded on August 30th, 2020, which, as everyone knows, is a lifetime ago. And the reason I've asked him back, as you will hear from his credentials, Stephen is someone who's devoted his career to understanding police departments with a psychoanalytic perspective, understanding the community with a psychoanalytic perspective, and understanding the interface, the often fraught interface between police departments and the community. Let me tell you something about his credentials, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about the history of our conversations. Stephen Marins is a child and adult psychoanalyst at the Yale School of Medicine, where he is the Harris Professor of Child Psychoanalysis and a professor of psychiatry and director of the Childhood Violent Trauma Center at the Yale Child Study Center. He is the co-developer of the Child Development Community Policing Program, a national model for police mental health partnerships that aim at diminishing the impact of traumatic events, the kinds of which police are regularly called to. He is also the co-developer of the Child and Family Traumatic Stress Intervention Program, the only evidence-based early brief intervention for children and families that interrupts and prevents the development of PTSD. A remarkable finding. It prevents the development of PTSD. His whole career has been focused on developing and implementing psychoanalytically informed responses to children and families and communities that have been traumatized by violent and catastrophic events. In addition to all this, Dr. Marins also has a practice where he treats children, adolescents, and adults in psychoanalysis and psychoanalytically informed psychotherapy. When I first contacted Stephen for this second conversation, We met early in the summer, where, as everyone knows, there were explosive reactions to police violence. And he and I met, and as we discussed in our conversation, you'll hear it soon, we decided to not have a podcast conversation. We thought the moment wasn't quite ready. And then here, at the end of August, months later, though crises continue, we've decided that we've listened to ourselves, we've listened to each other, we've listened to the various communities impacted, and we thought we could have a conversation that would be worthwhile. It will be up to the listener to determine if they agree with us that we've had a worthwhile conversation. But if you care to share your thoughts, reactions, and comments, you can do so at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org. Here's my conversation with Dr. Stephen Marins. Stephen, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Stephen, when the crisis around policing exploded in the States this past summer, the beginning of the summer, you were the first person I thought of. And that was because you and I had a podcast conversation last September 2019, episode 16, where you described in really lovely and poignant detail the profound work you've done and your group have done in New Haven, working with police departments and working in the community. And the best way to summarize what you communicated, though I do recommend that episode for a fuller description, is when there is a crime committed in a home, two people are called. The police department is called, and you're called. And you will go out with the police in their car and attend to the crime. Let's say there's a murder. And the police will attend to the aspects of the crime, and you will attend to the children. And you will follow those children in your own work and in your program's work to deal with the emotional sequelae of the trauma they witnessed, which really places you in the center of this storm we are in that you have long experience working with policemen, and you have long experience working in the community. So you and I had a one-on-one conversation this past summer during the height of this crisis. And we discussed the options of having a repeat podcast. And we came to the conclusion that this was not the right time to do so. And I had mixed feelings about it, though I think in retrospect it was the correct decision. At the time, I hadn't appreciated quite as much as I should have that there's a clinical analogy, perhaps, that is when someone comes in with an acute trauma, that isn't necessarily the time to reflect on layers of meaning. It isn't the time to consider historical antecedents to the trauma. It's a time to listen. And I think that's what we have done, which is not to suggest the crises are over, because we know they're not. But we listened, and here we are months later, again with more crises, but perhaps in a better position to have a conversation where we can explore meanings, and we can explore history, and we can reflect and really bring the best of your psychoanalytic ear to the interface of the community and the police. That's my take on our first attempt at meeting and now our meeting again, but I'm interested in yours.
No, I think it's a wonderful description, Harvey. And, you know, using the, not the clinical analogy, but the clinical phenomena is an important starting place, so that in the height of crises, in the height of the most intense experience of anxiety and distress, it's often the hardest time to ground ourselves in unpacking not only the details of our own personal phenomena, the experiences we're having, but also the ability to zero in on potential solutions to a better understood problem. And so I think that that was the last point at which we left our discussion. And I think that the issue about what's going on in our country, what's going on in terms of the response to policing is an important moment in our country's history. And it's also a difficult moment in terms of the intensity of feelings that so many have in response to the abuse of power, the abuse of force by police, and what that represents in the broader context of the history of Black and brown people in our country. And that, too, we know from the clinical sense that when we're having a big reaction to a current external source of distress, that we're not only having an experience in the present, but that vulnerabilities and experiences of the past are also powerfully aroused. So I think that the analogy is between the clinical experience and what we know from our work in our consulting rooms has great application in a broader sense to some of the challenges and difficulties in discussing, thinking about, and responding effectively to the current crises in our broader society.
Stephen, when you wake up in the morning and, like all of us, you see the headlines that we see, and by that I'm referring to abuses of power by the police or murders by the police. Everybody has their own reaction to that, but yours is, as I mentioned, is steeped in a long history of working with policemen and working with community members. What goes through your mind or what goes through your gut?
Well, many, many things. First and foremost, sadness. Sadness about the fate of victims, of their families, and sadness about the experience of the broader community for whom this kind of situation of feeling singled out, discriminated against, at times with fatal consequences, is not a new experience. And so I'm deeply saddened horrified. I'm also deeply saddened because the behavior on the part of police whose practices inspire such powerful reactions to individual family members as well as the broader community is in such contradistinction to the potential role that the police have and can play in actually being of assistance to citizens who at times need someone to lean on, especially in critical situations involving threats to health, safety, and welfare. So I'm saddened on many fronts. I'm also saddened because in our country, it's not the first time that there has been a call for police reforms. And it's not the first time that there has been a recognition that the excesses of police in certain communities, in too many communities, is a reflection of broader disparities and inequities in the broader social world, particularly for Black people and brown people. So what's also saddening is that we don't seem to be able to sustain the lessons that we've learned, both about the nature of problems and the various forms and shapes they take, nor of some of the effective attempts at solutions. So I wake up and I read the headlines and I'm pained like everyone else. And I have the perhaps additional experience of not only decrying the behavior of officers involved in murder, involved in excessive uses of force, involved in the picture of disrespect for our citizens, but also the frustration of having seen what can be achieved when police are able to assume a different role within the community in the broader context of taking the blinders off to the challenges that those communities face.
One of the things you mentioned in describing your work with police in our first conversation in September was the observation that the police see aspects of humanity, of our communities, that no civilian ever sees. And as a result, there's sort of a bonding together, that either you get their world and their predicament or you don't. Now, that obviously is both true and easily misunderstood and abusable. But you had to go through that that membrane to become accepted into their world. Can you share with us some reflections on that semi-permeable boundary, if you will, that people who are involved in the world and the work that they're involved with live in, and how that makes speaking their language and coming up with solutions particularly challenging?
Well, you know, it's a great question, Harvey. And I keep going back to the analogous situation in our consulting rooms, that, you know, walking in someone else's shoes is easier said than done. Mm. We know, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And the it's not only about needing the opportunity to learn as much as one can about the experience of someone else, but it's also recognizing that that learning process is through multiple filters, including our own personal reactions, both in the moment and what's aroused unconsciously in terms of counter-transferential phenomena. So it's not so dissimilar in terms of walking into any new arena of learning about someone else's experiences, but perhaps the challenges are even greater, but also more necessary when wading into the professional world of someone else, particularly when that professional world involves phenomena that is so likely to arouse our own personal responses, both in the most immediate conscious level and as well as at the unconscious level. So the task of being able to learn is not dissimilar, but some of the challenges can often be more immediate and actually dissuade people from wading into the world of responding police officers.
One of the phrases you used at our initial conversation was that the people involved and us observers of the situation as well are experiencing a narrowness of thinking.
Yeah.
And if I hear you right, that narrowness of thinking is what dissuades one from understanding what it's like to be a community member who's afraid of the police. Of a narrowness of thinking dissuades one from appreciating what it's like to be a policeman, woman, often involved in dangerous and life-threatening situations. And it's easy to fall back into simplistic good-bad models, which obviously is not intended to excuse terrible behavior. It's not that. It's to understand the everyday challenges of being in a community and being a policeman at the same woman at the same time.
Absolutely. And those challenges, as we know, are all the greater when we are, as human beings, when we're at our most aroused. So it's not surprising that our thinking becomes oversimplified when we're most upset. But I think that, you know, unfortunately, that that kind of more narrow thinking doesn't often allow us to unpack the phenomena that is such a major source of distress, nor to look at some of the possible solutions as one's getting into the details of understanding the facets of the problem itself.
And I guess while it's understandable that the people involved in violent episodes or potentially violent episodes are in a stress situation, a narrowness of thinking situation, those of us who are reflecting, or those like yourself who are in a position to suggest solutions, need broader thinking. And for yourself, broader in a particular psychoanalytic perspective, which can be so enriching. Let me use that as a segue. Solutions is a funny word. Every time I say it, I can't decide if I want to put air quotes around it or not. Mm. But in terms of remedies or efforts towards remedies, and there are communities that strikingly suffer from a lower percentage of troublesome interactions between the police and the community. So there is something that can be done. And you have been working in New Haven, you know, for 30-odd years. Tell us about it. Give us a details and also a reason to be optimistic that a change can occur.
Right. I mean, I go back to the inception of our work, which was really could only happen because there was a revolutionary change in the way that policing was being thought about and put into practice in New Haven. This idea about us versus them, the idea of anonymous policing, was one of the first lines of attack, as it were, from a police chief, Nick Pastor, in shaking things up, so that that anonymity, which perpetuates a divide between the community and police who are supposed to be working for that community, was one of the focal points of some of the reforms that Chief Pastor introduced. So that, simply put, for example, the idea that community policing is based on the concept of establishing relationships means that you can't have officers who are remaining anonymous in the very communities in which they work. That has direct implications in terms of some of the things that Chief Pastor put into practice, which was no longer having officers float from district to district, that they were given, you know, somewhat permanent assignments in neighborhoods. And the other was to move away from a 911-driven model only, and increasing contact between officers who are working in neighborhoods and contacts with the people who lived in those neighborhoods through walking beats, through all sorts of, you know, organized meetings, through joint police, community, neighborhood interactions, etc. So that was one factor. The other factor that Chief Pastor put into play was the idea that the police force needed to look more like the community. And it wasn't just for superficial purposes. It was a bold and very specific reflection and reaction to the fact that the police department looks so different from the community. And he was determined to make that change. And so active recruiting amongst Black and Brown people and women and people of different sexual orientations, et cetera, was an active stance on his part to have the department reflect the community itself. The other element had to do with training, in which there was a focused increase in training on a whole host of specific areas in which police were ultimately going to be involved in once they hit the streets. That had to do with better understanding severe psychiatric illness, homelessness, drug and alcohol, substance abuse, etc., and also included training on child development, human functioning, and acute responses to trauma, and the role that police could take in helping to stabilize immediate situations of traumatic distress, as well as the role that they could play in increasing the follow-up experience of safety and security, health and well-being. This in turn, in concrete ways, began to shift not only the functions and roles of police officers in the community, but also the ways in which the community could experience their police officers.
And you feel it's been effective?
Well, I think it's been enormously effective as a model, but I also think that, there have been changes in what happened in New Haven. New Haven was not the only community in the country in the 90s that was really taking community policing as a changing, significant shift in policing philosophy, as well as policing operations. I think there were, and there was enormous support from the U.S. Department of Justice, which was actually a major leader in supporting police reforms, federal dollars that helped support some of the transformation of policing concepts and operations around the country. Those things took a major hit and something of a nosedive, those efforts, following the attacks of 9/11, in which we saw a shift in funding as well as a shift in the leading edge philosophy of police reforms back to a more reactive and some might say a remilitarization of approaches to policing, which again, unfortunately, increases the vulnerability to us versus them. Mm. Police community interactions also de-emphasizes relationships and again puts police and community members into a very narrow bandwidth of interaction that I think only perpetuates and draws on the confirmation of the worst of excesses of policing as an instrument of oppression that unfortunately has been woven into the fabric of our country's history.
To borrow again from the clinical situation, it's as if anonymity increases transference, and in both directions, both from the police to the community and the community to the police. And when relationships are real, and when they're present and they interact with each other and get to know each other, that the worst isn't the first place one goes in one's mind, but the reality, if not the humanity of the other, is considered, if not embraced.
Absolutely. And I think, again, continuing what you're saying, Harvey, the idea that, transference phenomena is this idea in the clinical setting that, and is the basis for our understanding of repetition, compulsion, et cetera, which is the ways in which the relationships, self-object representations of the past are played out and, in fact, can distort the currency of here and now relationships and immediate experiences. Mm-hmm. But we also know that when reality conforms to those the earlier unwanted experiences and the resulting defenses, when reality conforms to those worst experiences and perceptions of others, that's a powerful and often incendiary combination.
Yeah. In this case, in both directions, I guess.
Absolutely. And I would also add that, yeah, part of policing, and again, the comparison or the analogy to the clinical situation is, that it's not only transference, but the more immediate experience and perhaps more observable immediate experience of displacement. So imagine the idea that if the police are called to your home because of something as simple as a noise infraction, let alone because of a domestic disturbance, what that might feel like in the context of an already existing sense of loss of control, failures of mastery, etc., and now having this figure of authority show up at your doorstep. Is it so surprising that we would imagine that the person who's answering the door may already feel under the gun of their own harsh judgments of themselves, and that when the police officer arrives, that police officer can be such an immediate point of externalization of superego, to which that individual may have a very powerful negative response. Let's take it a step further. Imagine you're the police officer who actually doesn't have much of a clue conceptually. You're new on the job and you don't really have, it's not woven into your training that this comes with the territory, right? And the same person that you're responding to because you're there to uphold the law, to set limits, etc., but you're greeted with a barrage of complaints and criticism, and the person's never even met you. Imagine what a disadvantage it would be for that officer to not even have a clue about appreciating that this comes with the territory of their profession, in the same way that it does in the consulting room, the difference being that hopefully the people who are working with the observations of displacement and transference are prepared enough that this is the bread and butter of what they do, not the exception and not the surprising phenomena to which they might respond with gut reactions only.
And just to add explosiveness to it, we, as you say, in the clinical situation are well-trained, have been through our own experiences, but also are in a very safe environment.
Absolutely.
And none of that applies to the policeman knocking on a door, and who knows what they're going to find behind the door.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And likewise for the person behind the door, they have uncertainties about what's going to happen when they open the door. It's really it's a terribly fraught moment. And I could imagine that only the greater training that you're suggesting could offer just some hope of lowering the temperature down a little bit.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the volatility on both fronts and the levels of fear and anxiety, again, apply to the situation in people's homes and on the street, which is, again, the heightened levels of anxiety and distress can narrow the sense of options and responses in those situations, even greater because of the potential for danger, than in the similar experiences in day-to-day life. I am reminded that, again, it's not only about training, but it's also about the broader context in terms of the development of relationships. I think I may have mentioned this in our previous interview, but I'm reminded of doing a training with recruits with a then sergeant who then rose to the rank of an assistant chief before retiring. And we were taking a break in our training with the recruits on development, human functioning, trauma, and policing responses. We were in the break, and the sergeant and I were walking down a hallway to get some coffee, and a small gaggle of recruits came following up behind, and they called out to the sergeant. They said, Sergeant, can we ask you a question? And the sergeant turned around and said, sure. And they said, well, and they, these recruits coming to the end of their training, and they said to him, and they said, Sarge, when we get out there, what do we do? And it was such a lovely question, because these were recruits who were about to go out, you know, for the first time with FTOs, but still really quite uncertain and anxious. And the sergeant did a beautiful job. He said, you know, I had the same feeling when I first went out. And he said, I'll never forget. You know, we didn't have FTOs back then, but I'll never
forget. FTOs or what?
I'm sorry, field training officers. After somebody finishes their training, they're then under the wing of a field training officer for several months.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'll never forget when I first went out there, and I remember walking in the neighborhood that I was assigned to and being really quite frightened. And he said, what I imagined was that, you know, danger was lurking around every corner. And I was talking to a senior officer who said, you know, the best way to begin the job is to meet as many people as you can. The more that you know the people who are in the neighborhood you're patrolling, the more that you can count on their having your back if you ever need it. But more important, you know that there are people here who offer no threat, and you get to know the contours of where the dangers lie and where they don't, which allows you to operate in a more judicious and responsive fashion.
Mm. And that applies to the people he's meeting as well.
Absolutely.
That they see that there's a person there. Right, right. And safety can triumph over fear.
Absolutely. But remember that cops, and this is, I'm talking about the best cops, not the worst trained, not the most inappropriate candidates for being police officers. These are all enormous challenges and problems that need to be addressed and fixed in how police recruitment occurs, how training occurs, etc. But remember, the police carry a burden that is a reflection of the generations of burdens that people in the Black community in particular, but the Brown community, immigrant community, have carried for you know, over since the founding of our country, which is the ways in which the police are the most obvious and out there representation of a society that has long disenfranchised, oppressed, both legally and after the law, since the founding of our country. So they too carry the immediacy of the police carry the immediacy of the experience that the community has endured since the founding of our country. So it's no surprise that there is a ready-made opportunity for the transference of the past in the present, sure, as well as the more immediate displacement of precipitating circumstances that bring police to people's homes.
Stephen, your use of the word immediacy really captures an essence of what we're talking about, because we're describing quieting the immediacy, adding ego functions and executive functions and perspective to take a moment and to reflect. And that also describes our own history with our struggle with this conversation, and when we thought it was too immediate. Yes. At the beginning of the summer, and it wasn't best. And we've taken time to reflect. And in anticipating our speaking this time, you weren't sure whether your reflections would be of interest to people and would be of value to people. And I reassured you that you don't know how much you bring to the table about this. You have decades of experience, and I'm grateful for your agreeing to do this. I'm grateful, as always, for learning from you. And in the first conversation, when I was appreciating your immersion again in the community and in the police departments, and you're working systemically and setting up programs, not only in New Haven, but throughout the country, I said what you were doing was revolutionary. And I want to reiterate that you are bringing the best of psychoanalysis. And as you described, you are continuing the long history of psychoanalysis, which includes involving itself in social conflicts and problems. And I am educated by your work. I'm deeply respectful of your work. And I want to thank you for agreeing to share your thinking with me and our listeners.
Well, thank you, Harvey. And just one final comment. You know, we talked before about the early trauma intervention that we've developed as a result of what we've learned from the people to whom we've responded. But one of the centerpieces applies here that, you know, again, when we're at our most overwhelmed, we have the least amount of resources available to actually bring the level of distress under control. And it's at those times that we understandably feel at our most helpless. And I do think that the same principle applies here, that at our most distressed, in the face of tragedy that immediately families experience when loved ones are abused or murdered, or entire communities or an entire nation, that when we're at our most upset, it is the hardest time to appreciate not only the details of why we are upset, but also to appreciate that in seeing the details, we're far more better positioned to address solutions to the enormous problems that have given rise to the distress and the distressing circumstances in the first place. I hope that out of these tragedies, that there is an opportunity, first, not only to express the intensity of our reactions, but then to get back down to the detailed business of understanding, unpacking the nature and contributions to the problems, as well as to revisit and learn new solutions in achieving greater mastery. That in and of itself could be as much about the work that we do in our psychoanalytic consulting rooms as it is about the work that we attempt to do in the community and with other professionals who deal intimately, deeply, and often in troubling ways with the complexity of what it is to be a human being, especially in times of distress.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.